Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I am Pranay Kotastane and I have with me General Prakash Menon. And today we are going to discuss something about military affairs. So a few days back, there was an unfortunate incident. There was a terrorist attack in North Kashmir and the CO of 21RR, Colonel Ashutosh Sharma, was killed in action during that terrorist incident. So on that basis, General Menon had written an article regarding the role of the commanding officer in the Indian military setup. And I thought it would be very valuable for our listeners to know what exactly the commanding officer is and what are the challenges for this role in the future. So welcome, General Menon, to discuss this topic.
Thank you.
General Menon, let's begin with this first topic itself, that you write that the role of the commanding officer is central to the functioning of the Indian Army's operations. So why did you write that? Why do you say that?
Because the battalion is the smallest tactical unit which is at the cutting edge of combat effectiveness. Mm-hmm. Because the powers that inheres in the commanding officer, and he is a very powerful man, including the powers of punishment. And under him, normally about 1,000 or slightly less or more people, including officers, JCOs and other ranks, carry out their task. Mm-hmm. And the task is normally given to the battalion. Mm-hmm. And it is the commanding officer's responsibility to fulfill the task given to it. And the commanding officer's responsibility, therefore, to also make sure that he is able to derive maximum capacity from that unit, which is the battalion, and deploy its human and other resources towards the fulfillment of that task. And all the time, keeping in mind also the care for the lives and limbs of the men under his command. So it is a very onerous responsibility.
So operationally, it becomes really central to any sort of tasks which are performed on the field, right?
That's right. Yeah. He's the one who's given the task, who's made responsible for it, he plans for it. And in case the task involves other parties, he is the main guy who is at that edge where the operational task is carried out, where under whom all tactical actions take place.
Right. That is clear now. General Menon, but in this case, there was a colonel as the commanding officer, right? Is it normal for the Indian military setup to have a colonel taking part in action as the commanding officer, or are there some other positions also who lead this?
Well, actually, This is an issue which people need to understand. And the question often asked, and especially the senior leadership always asks this question, that why is it that the commanding officer was there in the middle of the action? Why couldn't it be somebody else, a junior, a younger person? And why is it the commanding officer? I think this question fails to recognize the ambience in which these operations are being carried out. Counterinsurgents, where firstly, there are no fronts as we understand it. But any person who's there in that ambience can actually become a front itself.
Right.
And therefore, in this particular case, we have to judge it in the context of what has happened here. That why did the commanding officer actually get killed? What are the circumstances? So we must give the commanding officer the latitude to decide where he wants to go, when he wants to go, what he needs to do. That cannot be dictated by SOPs and rules. Yes, guidance is always there, but I'm afraid to say that he should not do this and he should not do that would be tying the hands of a man who must be given the maximum freedom possible, because nobody can know what is the element of risk which you are subjecting yourself to. It's impossible to calculate. It is okay for me to sit in the peace of Bangalore and ask the question, why is the commanding officer there? I think it is, they don't understand the very idea that the commanding officer can be, should be, wherever he wants. So this commanding officer took a choice. Mm. He got a certain information. He took his, what is called a quick reaction team, rushed to the spot along with his company commander, who also had his quick reaction team. In all probability, these might be the people, only people immediately available. And time might have been of consequence. Mm. But it is not for us to judge. Because that decision is made by the commanding officer, and the commanding officer must, and future commanding officers must be allowed to make that decision. It cannot be ordained from top. It will be unfortunate. So this commanding officer made this decision. He rushed to the spot where the terrorist was supposed to be. Unfortunately, he came under fire, his entire group, and five people were killed, including the police. But that's what is combat about. That you put your life at stake, and every soldier who's there, death stalks him. But that doesn't mean that he succumbs to the fear and saves himself. Instead, he tries to do his duty and yet keeping the instinct of survival alive. But it might not always work, because there is an adversary on the other side who might just have the luck at that point, at that time, on his side. And I'm afraid here, it might be the case. So there's nothing wrong if a commanding officer has led his troops, led his men into a particular dangerous situation and succumbed to it. It just shows what the ethos of the army is, that the leaders in the field lead, that our company commanders and platoon commanders and our battalion commanders are in front. That is the ethos of the Indian Armed Forces, especially the Indian Army. And we've been in counterinsurgency for now nearly 60 years, maybe more than that. And this is the ethos which has been passed on from one generation to another. It has stood the test of time, although it has always comes in the terms of the sacrifices that have been made. Right. But that is the cost with the institution has decided it will pay. For we have the best men probably in the world as far as the armed forces is concerned. The only thing which is required is they should be led well, and they will achieve things much beyond the imagination. So the Indian Army has embraced the commanding officer as that linchpin who will lead the way that he wants to, the manner that he wants to, and let that remain.
Right. So, General Manu, you mentioned about counterinsurgencies. Would it be true to say that in a counterinsurgency, the lines are more blurred for the commanding officer's role, whereas in a front war or a conventional warfare, there would be better protocols and SOPs and the roles will be much well-defined?
Well, actually, these are all generalizations, but one would say in a general sense, in counterinsurgency, the commanding officer has much more independence than he would have had in conventional war, because he would be part of a much larger scheme of things. Yeah. Here, he has an independent area of responsibility, and it is in this area of responsibility he does what he thinks is best. Yeah. So, you cannot compare, because independence here is much more. Conventional war would probably require him to conform to a much larger picture.
Understood. So now next question, gentlemen, and that you would also written in this article, and we link to it in the episode description, that the performance of units waxes and wanes as the commanding officers change. Obviously, because they are the linchpins, everything depends on them and their own attitude, how they lead their men might change the performance of the units. But don't you see then that as an institutional weakness, given that the performance depends on an individual and the individual's persona. So how does the army get around this limitation?
It's a very interesting question, actually, because every unit, depending upon its vintage, how long its hold has been, inheres within it a tradition, which actually can carry even a weak commanding officer, because that unit itself has gotten certain entrenched traditions. But even despite that, the fact that the unit has got a weak commanding officer will have to finally reflect somehow or the other in the performance of the unit, because this is the man who decides nearly everything. He's the man who has to make the plan. He's the man who has to allot the resources. He's the man who has to carry out the coordination. He's the man, and this is the most important, who fires the spirit of the unit. So in this singular institution, and that's why I say it's an institution, lies the ability to achieve or not achieve. So although institutional strengths of units are there, they cannot but be influenced by the man at the top to a differentiated extent, depending upon the unit strength itself, the context at in play, and also what is the set of circumstances, the context. And that is very important. So institution, definitely, it's not that both the commanding officer's institution and the institution of the battalion itself are important, but the structure and the military hierarchical system makes this vulnerable to the man at the top, who's the commanding officer. I don't think you can take that away because you've given him so many powers. So it cannot be said that it don't make any difference if commanding officers come and go. In fact, it makes all the difference on the other hand. And we believe that difference is crucial. And that is why selection of commanding officers as a process by which there is a lot of people who can get left behind, because it's very competent.
Right. So given this role and the centrality of this role, let's discuss what are some of the challenges that the Indian Army faces regarding this institution of the commanding officer.
Yeah, I think the first challenge which we face is we must understand that the nature or the character of war is changing, or because of the fact that this idea of fronts, which we assume to be of permanent in its contours, is under change. And as the character shifts more towards unconventional than conventional, although conventional is also very relevant, the idea of fronts is also changing. It is morphing that any of the commanding officers, whether he belongs to the infantry, the supporting arm like the artillery, or even the logistic guy, can be in the front. Take, for example, the ongoing COVID-19 situation. So if the army had to be employed, it would be the medical which will be in front. So one of the things which we have to realize is that this guy, who normally we talk only in combat arms, is spread across the institution as a commanding officer. And he must be young, because risks are involved. He must be physically fit, and he must have been given adequate training. These three in combination should be what should be the attention. And we should not be anchored to the original idea which we previously harbored, that only combat commanding officers need be young, the rest can be a slightly older age. So any move which is trying to increase the age of the commanding officer, I don't think is wise. So the first thing is to keep the commanding officer young.
And you would say that because the risk-taking ability sort of decreases with age? Is that the assumption?
Of course it does. The fact that when you are young, you're much more, that's just how we are, humans are. It's not that older people cannot take risk, but the general trend is that here's a guy who can withstand, when you're young, more pressure than what the older people than him can do, because he's got youth and experience on his side. He's got both. So commanding officer is not somebody who's very young. He'll probably be in his mid-30s, but he's got experience and he's still young. Suppose you put a guy there who's in the 40s, then his physical fitness will be less and also his probably his risk-taking capabilities.
Right.
So that is why the Indian Armed Forces have so far made an attempt to bring down the age of commanding officers. There's been a deliberate attempt, but I am saying that not only combat, but everybody. And I'm also saying that because of this financial problem, pensions and so on, extending the age of officers for retirement, etc., is not a good idea because the army must remain as young as possible.
There was one more point, General Menon, in your article where you talked about the skill sets needed for a CO. And you said beyond the normal tactical warfare and how to command men, which is required, they also need to understand how the political system works and be able to communicate that needs effectively with the political establishment. So could you elaborate on that point? What are the types of skill sets in addition to the tactical warfare required for a CO?
Yeah, I think even in conventional war, as also more importantly in counterinsurgency operation, for a commanding officer to understand the political vectors at play is very important. Let me explain what I mean. Remember, the military or the armed forces is an instrument of the politician. It has been applied for political purposes. So as you climb up the hierarchy of the military, you have to understand the political vectors at play. For a battalion commander in counterinsurgency, where the atmosphere is politically loaded, he has to be cognizant and sensitive to political forces so that his application of force does always supports what is the political objective. And what is the political objective for the battalion? What is the connection to the political objective of a battalion in counterinsurgency? One of the first things is to win over the hearts and minds of the people. Two is to neutralize as many terrorists as possible so that the impact of terrorism in the political environment is reduced. And when these two things happen, then probably political forces can play their role and bring peace. So the battalion commander is an element in this. Suppose he carries out an operation in which there is collateral damage of civilians and it is accidental, not intentional, but it can always have an effect on how the people views the armed forces and the effect on how you can win hearts and minds. So unless you are cognizant of the political and emotional atmosphere of the people, you might do things which might affect the political objective in the long run. Therefore, understanding it is important. So what I'm saying is that the commanding officer, through his training process, and even the company commander, must become cognizant of this. And that's what training should do. It is not that we make them politicians. They have to understand politics. And there is a difference. The apolitical nature of the armed forces must be preserved at all costs. But if you don't understand politics, and this is more and more relevant as you go up the hierarchy, especially of the chiefs and the army commanders and so on, the corps commanders, that they have to understand the larger forces at play. So it is about widening perspectives. That is what I mean to say.
Right. Yeah, just a distaste of politics wouldn't work because finally politics always exists and it needs to be taken on board in order to achieve objectives. So Gentlemen, one more issue that you had mentioned about was how a large number of deserving candidates are left out because of the hierarchical nature of the system. And you had proposed a solution about the NFU system. Could you detail that?
Yeah. Because of the fact that this, this is the selection of the commanding officer is actually it's like a bottleneck where you are very strict about who you'll make as a commanding officer, because selection to that appointment is so important to the organization.
Right.
So selection is very strict. What happens is because of the strictness and because the competition is also, very intense, lots of good officers who should actually also could also become good commanding officers get left out. That is because of the pyramidal nature of the armed forces structure itself. But these are officers who are well experienced, who have the knowledge, and which the institution must be able to utilize it. So while you may not be able to give them rank, not be able to make them a colonel or a brigadier or a general, you should be able to compensate them at least in monetary terms. And that is why I suggested that the non-functional upgrade which has been applied to the civil services has not been applied to the armed forces. The issue is now, I think, in the Supreme Court. The MOD is fighting against it, and I would suggest that they change their stance, or not because of anything else, but because we need these officers and we must give them some motivation to be as effective and as efficient that their experience can give them. So that is why I said that NFU should be applied to the armed forces.
Gentlemen, if I understood right, the NFU will help the officers monetarily, but it won't make them a commanding officer, right? So how is the system going to actually help in the selection system of the COs themselves?
No, it won't help in the selection system of the COs. You know, these are, what I'm saying is, because you can make very few people COs out of a much larger lot of officers, but those other officers can be utilized in many other places within the armed forces. They must be kept motivated. And that is something because the organizational requirement is of having a strict selection to COs. It is not like the civil services where nearly everybody will actually move up in course of time. Right. The number, the percentage of people who are selected as COs is very small. In fact, I think in the infantry, it would probably be about 50%, maybe 60%, maybe less. So what happens to the others? So they must be given some motivation.
Thanks, gentlemen. So now we'll round up this episode by going back to the incident in North Kashmir itself. So the death of the CO of 21RR, that would have hit the unit morale definitely. And you're right that the army had acted swiftly and replaced another CO. So what was the positive thing that you saw in this?
I had written actually that the moment a unit CO dies in combat, it affects the morale of the unit. It's like losing your father, you know. So the army acted very swiftly in identifying a new CO, and they did not send a new promotee there. They sent an experienced CO who had already commanded, had done his higher command course, was headed for the military operations directorate, which is a very committed appointment. But they selected him specially, and they asked for volunteers. And I'm told that there were many volunteers. The guy was finally selected with this chap. And next day, he was rushed to that unit to take over command. And I'm told that even the colonel of the regiment had accompanied me, because to restore the unit's morale was the first organization step which is required. You require a very good CO to do it, because you are under combat conditions. And I must credit the Indian Army and the MS branch for that really speedy action.
Thanks a lot, General Menon. This was very, very interesting, and I'm sure that our listeners will like and understand this role of the commanding officer in the Indian Army much better after this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.